gents, I'd like to welcome back Norm Kendry, G3 CSG. I think most of us know Norman. He's been back to the club many times. And last time we enjoyed him so much, we decided to ask him back to do it again. So, Norman, over to you. I believe it's Japanese Morse as the lecture. So over to you, Norman.
Thank you very much. Well, good evening, gentlemen, and before we start the lecture this evening, I would like to say how much I enjoy Basil's do. We were calling it Basil's coronation, and when I was presenting it, I did a curtsy to Eileen, and Basil got a bit frightened when I tried to kiss him on each cheek. I think he knew I was ex-Navy and he wondered what was coming next. But it was a smashing do. And if anyone heard me bawling and shouting and convulsing about, I was quite sober. I did enjoy myself. It was very, very nice. Very nice indeed. I feel a bit of a fraud coming back so soon, somehow. And all the time I keep on saying, what can I put in new to this talk? And I feel that if I do, I'll be telling lies. It's so easy over the years to embellish, and it's very, very difficult to keep track of something that happened, what is it now, 30 odd years ago. And so I'm sticking strictly to the script with regards to the actual content. But I might have one or two anecdotes that those of you who have heard it before might be a little bit different. I was reminded of one only last week, which I forgot all about until Peter reminded me of it. It has nothing to do with Japanese Morse at all. It actually happened, and you must hear it. I'd love to have had it on film, but we didn't have videotape or whatever in those days. Along with five other naval ratings, I was sat on a jetty in Trincomalee, which is in northeast Sri Lanka now, down Ceylon, waiting to be taken out to a ship. And a very smart naval cutter was coming in from the harbour. And up Potter, standing on the forecastle, if you could describe the fore end of such a small vessel, a forecastle, was a seaman complete with hook and smart in his gaiters and belt. And it was ferrying a person I found out later to be the port radar officer. We were rather tired having come up from Colombo through the night on a train, and we were dirty and disheveled and unkempt and weren't feeling particularly friendly towards anyone. And we watched this boat come in, and we thought, well, when he comes ashore, I suppose we'd have to stand up, but we'll leave it until the last possible minute. And we were like this. And the boat swung in expertly, and the seaman turned and flung out his hoop to capture the landing, you know? And the naval officer, I think a lieutenant commander, they had a wonderful habit of springing ashore, turning round in midair, landing on the jetty and throwing one up, which is goes back to Nelson's time, as you know, salute and then leave. Well, he jumped ashore and swung round, but the seaman had missed, and he disappeared. And he landed about to here in oily water as a result of previous bombing. And I can still And we sat there and we just rolled about and laughed. And of course when he scrambled out, he was obviously going to go with the seaman. But we stood up by our hammocks and just glared at us and walked off absolutely filthy. When the war was over, my brother-in-law took me to what is now the BBC Television Centre, but then belonged to Gaumont British. It was their film place in Lime Grove. To show me the film industry, I was like this about maybe doing something like that for a living. And I was still in naval uniform, and we had to sew up on our uniform SEAC, S-E-A-C. The rumour had it was to let the young ladies in England know where we'd been and to leave us strictly alone. But whether that was just a rumour or a buzzing recording. But I had these flashes up on my uniform, and I was still in the Navy and on leave. And we were going round this studio, and there was a fellow there, a sound engineer. And he looked around, and he slid his phone forward. He said, "Oh, see ya." He said, "I've just been demobbed from there, just got back." And I said, "Oh, yeah." I said, "What are you doing out there?" So he said, "I was the port radar officer at Trincomalee." And I said, "Now, what do I know about the port radar?" "Oh," he said, "you've heard it as well." I said, "No, I was one of those six trainees sat on the jetty." And typical of a naval officer, he said, "We'll have a drink on it afterwards." And that was my whole experience in the Navy. I haven't really done it. I was going to say, but he's gone and foiled it, that this lecture was particularly requested by Arthur Russell, who's at home watching TV, but he's just gone and walked in.
Sorry, I did make my apologies to our vice chair.
Nice to see you again. This talk, or diversion, I think a Victorian would call it a diversion, goes back for a long time now, and I should imagine this is getting on probably for about the 30th or 40th time that this thing has been trundled around. It's doing its present rounds as a result of a conversation on 2 meters with a couple of friends from Warrington who said that some of the older hands had heard it, and would I be prepared to go up there again and do it? And because the whole thing's on overhead projector transparencies, and my lecture notes are there, and all you need is a mouse key, and away you go. And I quickly accepted the invitation because I like it probably more than the listener, particularly if there are ribald comments from the audience, applicable to Merseyside, and it was very applicable to Warrington, I might add. And we had a wonderful evening there, and then they started talking about it on 2 meters, and so it's doing the rounds, and then it kind of dies for about 5 years, and then they kind of dig it up again. And that's we come here tonight because Dennis rang me and asked if I could make it for this evening. The title of the entertainment is Japanese Morse. And there are still a lot of people who think that there is no such thing. They think it's a giggle, rather like Japanese ladies or Chinese ladies and all those other rumours that we know about. They had to have their beds sideways in the room, this type of thing. But it is a fact there is such a thing as Japanese Morse. And indeed, the language that they use, my son tells me, my younger son, and has shown me that the language is now used on computers, and there's katakana text that is being used for the Japanese to communicate with the West. He actually showed me the symbols last week, and they're the same ones that we use. I suppose the appeal of this, if it does appeal at all, lies in the fact that people wonder how a picture language such as Japanese could be put into Morse anyway. Japanese is a form of hieroglyph, and any of you who've read about the origins of language and the written word, and television has popularized this enormously, and I've read a great deal about it out of interest, we think arose in the Middle East. And although the Sumerian and early civilizations, and I'm talking about pre-Egyptian, used a form of symbols for their words, I suppose the best example is the Egyptian hieroglyph, where every word had to have a picture. There was no such thing as an alphabet, no such thing as letters. And the ancient Egyptian hieroglyph, which is that's to be found on the monuments and tombs in Egypt today, was that particular language. And yet even the Egyptians had learned at that time to take these pictures and not just use them to represent things, but also meanings, including verbs and so on. So I suppose with languages like Japanese and Chinese and so on, they have a similar setup. We have Chinese kids in the school in which I work, and they're delightful kids too, and some of them can actually write in their own language. And here's another diversion. I have a headmaster who is the last word in class. You don't say good morning to him. You write it in triplicate. Give him a copy, pass one to your head of department, and file the other one. And he never ever sets foot inside a classroom other than to have a word with a teacher. And I believe that teachers were trained to teach, and that's where they belong, and that's where I spend most of my time when I'm at work. And he's very funny about his reports, this fellow. No longer like when we were kids, you know, where you got a single line like could do better or, you know, generally fair progress. Or the ones that we used to write, could do better if I worked harder. You know. You can't get away with that anymore. You must have a complete page. And you're writing a complete page on a kid, you see, an hour a week. And you've got about 300 odd kids, so that's really difficult. And I suddenly thought I'd have a little prank on this fellow with one of the Chinese students. And having sought the lad's permission, a charming fellow about 15, Sulat Thai, and I said, could I write his report in Chinese? Not that I can write it, but I have it written in Chinese, and I'll show it to you for approval, I said to him, so that nothing nasty is said about it, because I won't know. And we set this fellow up with this joke. And one of the senior girls, he's an 18-year-old in the sixth form, and she wrote this report, which means nothing to me. And I had to get it past blocks and checks on the way to make sure it got on his desk, because there are other people who see them before the manager. And this fellow ended up with the report on his desk. And all it said was, Sulat Thai, 4-2.
Here's a thing now.
And I signed it at the bottom with a Chinese version of my signature, Norman Kendrick, which was this, if this will write. I signed my initial like that, you see, so that it looked a bit Chinese. and that actually happened a couple of weeks ago, much to everyone's delight. But the language itself, we have an example of a picture language. For instance, originally in Chinese, it's not so today, I checked it, but a symbol like that simply meant a room, because it shows the four walls, you see, and that would be a room. Similarly, that would be a man showing the trunk, two arms and two legs. Because of the inferiority of woman in the East, there's only half a man. and it's still like that, although China's getting more with it, and Japan and so on, but still a lot of that about. And if you put a woman and a man in a room like that, that was contentment. You can see how by adding to the pictures, and I'm told by my Chinese pupils at school that this sort of thing still goes on, they build up pictures and extend on them by adding little bits, but this is how they do it. I'm sure that this isn't Chinese. That's a Norman Kendrick version. But this is the way a picture language can be built up. you can divide your own pictures. That one was devised by Colonel Custer just before the Battle of the Little Bighorn. Just make sure my key is working. Which says, holy mackerel, look at all those Indians. You can actually divide it up. I was going to the last step. You've got to be careful. But, yeah. Yes, I know, I'm playing very coolly. But the problem was, how did the Japanese solve this business of taking a picture language and devising more symbols for it? Now, I'm told that you need about 10,000 words to communicate at something of a reasonable basic level. And there's no way that even Samuel Morse could have devised a means of having a Morse symbol for 10,000 different words. Imagine the combination of dots and dashes to get there. Quite impossible. So they had to find another way around it. And they did. They devised a system that we call katakana. And as I say, you're going to hear more of this, any of you are in computers, my son has shown me, and they're the same symbols that I use. And it's called katakana. And what they did, they broke away completely of the concept of having to make more symbols for their words as they knew them. And instead they took their words and they broke them down into phonetic sounds. And they said, how many different phonetic sounds, including sibilants, not just the phonetic sounds, but sibilants as well, would you need to make up a word? And later on I will show you just how these words were built up. But I'm going to now start at where I came on the scene. As a young fellow of 17 and a half, I volunteered to join the Navy in the last war. Mainly, I think, not out of any intense patriotism, but the fact that I had three brothers who were in the forces. And I thought they weren't going to come home and tell me tales unless I got some to tell back. I think it was as simple as that. And I suppose a sense of adventure. But I volunteered, and I went along to Liverpool for a medical examination. And I said I would only volunteer, because you see, you waited till you were 18 to be called up. He said, I said, I'd only volunteer for anybody that could be a telegrapher. And the recruiting marine said, oh yes, we quite understand that, which was the biggest load of rubbish ever, because the Navy later on would decide whether I was suitable to be a telegrapher, no matter what I wanted to be. But I tell the tale of after you'd done your medical, they sat you down in a chair. They had an MO on one side and one on the other, and one looked down one ear, the other looked down the other. And if they could see each other, they either made you an officer or a delegate. But that's not true. That's an embellishment. I've got to be careful, you say, I'm being taken. Anyway, I eventually got in the Navy just on my 18th birthday, and went to a place called Royal Arthur Skegness. Used to call it Billy Buckling's Navy. And having done our square bashing and all the rest of it, we were then tested to see if we were suitable to be trained as telegraphists. Looking back on it, I think what they did was to send us some text in plain language, and not any one of us knew a letter of Morse. And we were simply asked to put a tick on our pants every time we heard two consecutive sounds which were alike. Now, we will know now, of course, that it's simply a double letter second, if they're sounding efficient. You go. You see, the two Fs, consecutive like that. I think it's coming to about 20, it's a bit slower than that. And we were all putting our ticks down, not knowing whether we were right or wrong. And of the 300 who were sat around these tables with headphones on in Butlin's holiday camp, they selected 100 of us to be telegraphers. And when I got my paybook, I found written on the top of it my number and this, tell brackets S. And we asked them what this S stood for, and of course they wouldn't tell us. So us young 18-year-old romantics were saying, for special service. And we had visions of us creeping into enemy territory and God knows what. And of course it was nothing like that at all. We went down to Brighton and they taught us more. And after, well, down 3 weeks, well, about 6 weeks I suppose, of school hours, 9 till 4, and a 2-hour lunch. What a lovely way to go. A GH delight, I suppose. We eventually got up to 22 words a minute. And we had our standard buzzer exercises, and most of us passed, a few didn't, most of us passed and went on. And we moved a few yards along the coast to Eastbourne, and there they took us up to 25 words a minute. And there we got our first indication as to what we were going to do. They started to teach us German and Italian procedures. So we then knew the cat was out of the bag, we were going to spend our war listening to the enemy. We learned their operating procedures and we learned the barred letters that Germans use and so on, the U-bar, what have you, the umlaut. And we took our exercises in that and we took our tests in that. And by this time others had come up after us, and about 100 of us training there come from other places. And we took our final exercises, and we were all fallen in on the parade ground and told where we were going. You know, the following ratings are going here, and the following ratings are going to HMS such and such. And they went through all this long until there were 20 of us left, and I was one of them. And they said the following ratings are going to London for further training. I can remember it like it was yesterday. So we all automatically assumed that we hadn't done very well in our final tests, but there was enough hope for us to actually, with more training, succeed. Why we had to go to London, we didn't know. We went on leave. We went to Wimbledon. When we got there, as an adult looking back on it, it was like an Alfred Hitchcock set. It was a big old sandstone building with thick walls and high hedges, and naval guards posted outside with belt and gaiters and armed. I thought, God, what's going on in here? You know, we won't be able to sneak over the back wall of this light and go this place and get up to Soho. And when we got in there, it was very obvious where we'd got to. There were people walking around in enemy uniforms, there was people speaking a whole variety of languages. And it was quite clear that we'd landed in some intelligence training unit. And we were instructed that we were to talk to none of these people. And they likewise were instructed not to talk to us. And we met our instructor, who was a fellow who'd been out at the Far East at the time of Pearl Harbor and the run-up to it. And he told us that we were to forget everything that we'd been taught. German, Italian, and all the rest of it, and we're starting over again. And we said, well, what are we going to start? And I always remember him, he had a typical Englishman with a quiet, sardonic smile and stiff upper lip. He
He said, Japanese.
If I had some bicycle clips, I'd have put them on the cross of the dial. It's quite frightening. But it turned out not anything like as bad as you might suppose. Because we found that the letters that we already knew in the international system, A, B, C, D, and E, and so on, in our system, the symbols were still the same. An A was still a didar, and a B was still a dar, and did it, and a C was still a dar, did it, and so on. But we also had to learn that when we heard this, we wrote that. A Japanese operator would write that. And it didn't matter whether you were Japanese, English, or whatever. To all of us, it said, eh. In other words, this was katakana. They had said that that symbol had been chosen to represent the it sound in any of their words. Forget the picture language. Learn a new set of pictures, which we can see here. Similarly, B, we could write it as B. The Japanese operator would write it like that. And to he and us, it said ha. Ha, so. And C says nip, and D says ho, and so on. And here are the Japanese symbols, here are ours, and here's the Morse, which is common to both. And here are the phonetic sounds that they make. So it's as simple as that. And later on you'll see how we can string these sounds together and actually make sounds that you yourself will recognise. And we went on right through the alphabet in exactly the same way. We didn't have to learn any of this. I picked this up since in doing these talks when I've come across information. I've jotted it down and added it to the talk to make it more interesting. All we were taught was that, which we already knew anyway. And at this stage, we only had to remember that N says yo, and N says ta. And what you did, you did a switch in the mind. You said yom, tam, and so on. And that said neck, you see. We had little tricks like that to remember it, which is quite commonplace. And it wasn't too difficult. We didn't have to bother with any of this, of course. And then you went on like that until you got to the alphabet. And there they were. But by the time they got to the end of the alphabet, they found that they hadn't anything like enough symbols to actually meet their requirements. They needed a lot more symbols for other phonetic sounds and consonants and so on. So they went to the barred letters, which we hadn't been taught. We've been taught a few. So that's where our learning started, barred letters. And you also had to learn, we wrote them like that, and you also of course had to learn the sounds that they made. But they still hadn't got enough. So they invented some of their own, which are not in any other system other than katakana. And there they are. We call this TL, we call this L backwards, a tent on its side, an O tail, a query, like one of those fellows in the little room, a long G, a negative, an oblique stroke, which we all use, a long dash, which some people still use, I've noticed, And we call that end of work, don't we, a plus sign. And I'll send you those to let you hear what they sound like. Is it too fast? Do you want me to slow it down?
No.
And at 2 o'clock in the morning when you're operating, you have to be a little bit awake to recognise the difference between, you know, when it's coming at about 30, which is what they do, a tent on its side, hotel, query, a long G, a negative, an oblique stroke, sorry, a long dash, is that 3 or 4 to get through? Whatever, can't remember that one, and that one. And here again, same business. These symbols, we wrote it like that. We call it, as I say, a tap line. We used to write it down like that. The Jap operator would write it like that. And to both of us, it would say that. But they even found that they still hadn't got enough symbols. And then someone hit upon the brilliant idea, very cunning, these oriental gentlemen, of using 2 more symbols only. The top little one, unless I'd drawn your attention to it, you wouldn't have noticed that there wasn't an eye, one of our eyes in the setup. And they used what we would use for an eye, for this thing called a niggory, N-I-G-O-R-Y. And I'll show you by demonstration in a minute how this was used to change the sound of our sound. You could harden or soften the leading edge, as you'll see. This thing was called a hand niggery. We were having a little chat before, and I was saying that as a kid I was a bit of a rebel. I've always been a bit of a roustabout, I suppose, in some way. And this guy who was teaching us was one of the nicest guys you could ever meet. He was a bit straight-laced. And at the time, Jack Benny, what was the Negro in Jack?
Rochester.
Everyone was trying to take off Rochester, was you mean? Oh, Mr. Benny, remember him? Yeah. And I was being taught this, and he told us in this lovely English, and this gentleman is a hen niggery. And I turned to the
I ain't no hen niggery.
I got 3 days combined about it. It worked. I'll tell you more about that guy later on, it was quite interesting. Now, how did we use these hand niggers? Well, let's have a look. Take a B, which says ha. But if you have a B followed by a niggery, sorry, then it changes and hardens up the leading consonant there to make it ba. It hardens it. They're called diacritical marks, but I've never ever found out what they mean. I read it in Wireless World. They call them diacritical marks. We simply call them niggeries. Another example there of a C bar says sa, and a C bar niggery says za. A D says ho, always remember that because it said hard, you see, ho. Says ho, but D niggery hardens it into bow. And by the use of these niggeries and hand niggeries, they were able to do this thing. The hand niggeries, they generally tended to soften the leading edge of the word or of the sound but not necessarily. There's a Z bar. Says, hi, Z bar Hanegri. It's only one symbol there. Says pi. E says he. E Hanegri says P, and no comments. And then the D again. Ho. D Hanegri. Says po. And you sometimes got those two together. So how can these sounds then be put together to make words that I think you, when they've been translated, will recognise? I've tried to choose words that you'd recognise. Now I've given there, I've lifted out some of the symbols and the sounds they make. And if we look at this symbol here, we look for the sound it makes, find the damn thing.
Both in the bottom.
Okay, there it is. There it is. It's na. If we look for that one, for the Hanegri, it says ga. See, the Hanegri gives you the hard G to lead the end. If you look at this one, it says sa. And if you look at that one there, it says ki, Nagasaki. Okay? And we all know about Nagasaki, much to our shame. Similarly, if you look at this one here, you'll find it. That says he. That says ro. That says she. Except they never said it like that. No. And if I can find it, that says ma. Hiroshima. I honestly have forgotten what I've written here. Oh, I know, yes. This one here says fu. That one says ku. Can you see it? Ku. And if I can find it,
yeah.
That one says ya. Don't worry, it's not what you think. And that one says ma. Fukuyama. Very good, Monty 700 TX. Hustle! Yeah, I just thought you'd like to see that. That's the rig I've got at home for 2 meters chat about. And there you go. I just picked that word up and I said, I'll put that into katakana. I thought a gentleman on the Japanese side was the wartime leader, Yamamoto, who was a very nice guy, actually. He wasn't one of the military hardliners. But the war cabinet drove him into leading Japan. He planned Pearl Harbor. And eventually, through our lot, he was shot down and killed. Well, perhaps I'll mention how that was done later on. And his name was Yamamoto. So if you wanted to get his name down, you can see it there. And we used to say Yamamoto. Because at the time we didn't know he was a particularly nice guy. We just wanted him out of the way. So that shows how the system is used, how it can be put together to make sounds that make sense. I did say if I had time, only something for tea.
No, yeah, no,
for tea.
Yeah. So you break now?
As you wish.
Okay. And then I'll pick up the story after tea and get on with it.
Okay.